Saturday, 26th of December, the former Conservative Cabinet Minister Theresa Villiers told BBC Breakfast, "I very much hope this treaty stands up to scrutiny and I hope to be able to support it, but I was elected on a manifesto which promised to get Brexit done, so I need to read the document before I can work out whether this actually enables us to do that or whether it traps us in the regulatory orbit of the European Union." The European Union's 27 member states have indicated they will formally back the deal within days. EU ambassadors were briefed on its content by Michel Barnier, who led Brussels' negotiating team in the talks with the United Kingdom. After a highly unusual meeting on Christmas Day, with at least one diplomat wearing a Santa hat and another a festive jumper, they agreed to write to the European Parliament to say they intended to take a decision on the provisional application of the deal. Downing Street's chief Brexit negotiator David Frost hailed the so-called beginning a moment of national renewal and claimed the deal ensures the UK sets its own laws again. David Frost said, "The way we've achieved this, that there is no more role for the European Court of Justice, there is no direct effects of European Union laws, there's no alignment of any kind, and we are out of the single market and out of the customs union, just as the manifesto said we would be." David Frost claimed, "This should be the beginning of a moment of national renewal for us. All choices are in our hands as a country, and it's now up to us to decide how we use them and how we go forward in the future." According to a BBC report, the deal goes beyond the bloc's so-called Canada-style trade accord. The document, which includes about 800 pages of annexes and footnotes, reportedly includes a late compromise on electric cars. The European Union has sought to offer tariff-free access only to those British vehicles that are made mostly with European parts. This measure will now be phased in over 6 years, but is less generous than the UK had requested. There is also a commitment not to lower standards on the environment, workers' rights and climate change, with mechanisms to enforce this. There is a mutual right to rebalance the agreement if there are significant divergences in future that are capable of impacting trade. The dispensations go beyond standard free trade agreements such as those between the European Union and Canada or the European Union and Japan, reflecting the United Kingdom's history in the single market, which was established in 1993. The Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove suggested the agreement would provide a fresh start for the United Kingdom and the European Union, enabling them to build a special relationship between sovereign equals. Writing in the Times, Michael Gove said he hoped it would spell an end to the rancorous and at times ugly politics seen since the European Union referendum. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer is facing the prospect of a revolt within his own party after instructing MPs to vote in favour of the deal. Sources confirmed to The Guardian that several frontbenchers were likely to resign over the vote. Many Labour MPs had urged Keir Starmer to recommend abstaining in the vote, warning that he would be unable to criticise the government for the economic consequences of the deal if Labour Party supported it. But Keir Starmer said leadership is about taking tough decisions in the national interest and being a serious, responsible opposition. He said, "At a moment of such national significance, it is not credible for Labour to be on the sidelines." Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, suggested on Saturday morning, 26th of December, that his party was likely to vote against the deal. Ed Davey said, "If the details turn out to be what we're hearing, we cannot support it." He added, "This will be so bad for British business, so bad for families to mean they're less safe. How can a responsible party support such a bad deal?" Davey also expressed concerns that the deal would make it more difficult for law enforcement bodies to share information. He said, British families will be less safe as a result of this deal. The criminals will be cheering as a result of this deal. That's not acceptable.
The United States assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis marked one of the most significant acts of terrorism by a state actor in recent history. Today we take a look at the fallout from this escalation and how it has shaped relations and tensions between the United States and Iran. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was killed on January 3, 2020, in an American drone strike near the international airport at Baghdad. He was assassinated alongside Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Sha'bi. Both men played an extremely vital role in the region, the importance of which cannot really be overstated. General Soleimani, or as he's also known, Haj Qasem, was a general in Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and the commander of the Quds Force. Quds means Jerusalem in Arabic, signifying the goal to liberate the Middle East all the way to Jerusalem from the illegal occupation by Zionist and Western forces. The Quds Force helped to establish Iran as a major force in the region and to defend Iran and its allies in several theaters of combat, fighting against Daesh, the United States, and the Zionist occupation. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was also assassinated in the same drone strike, was deputy commander of the PMU, or Hashd al-Sha'bi, which was formed in 2014, and is comprised of Shia, Sunni, Christians, and Druze militias, all fighting under one banner. Both these men were key players in the axis of resistance and a driving force all across the Middle East. Both the Quds Force and the Hashd al-Sha'bi were hailed across the Middle East by all ethnicities in Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Iraq, Yemen, for helping to coordinate resistance efforts and defend their lands from imperialism. Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played a key role helping to crush Daesh. The irony here is that not only did the United States and its allies give rise to the creation of Daesh, they then claimed to have defeated the problem that they created and killed Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi, who had done the real work. In reality, Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi have done more to fight terrorism, which the United States created, than anyone else. But because they also challenged U.S. hegemony, this is their real crime in the eyes of the Americans, and that's why they were killed. So this is why the United States always labels people who subvert their imperialist conquests as so-called terrorists, when actually they are the ones openly perpetrating terror. The United States attempted to justify this assassination by claiming it had intelligence that Haj Qasem was about to endanger American lives. Well, where is this intelligence? Because we've never seen it. Is it the same kind of intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If so, I would hardly put much faith in what U.S. intelligence has to say. They conveniently make up things as they go along in order to suit their foreign policy agenda and have no shame in doing so.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
Moreover, this idea that the United States can preemptively attack countries and murder people is the same doctrine and fabricated defense that they used to justify the war in Iraq, to justify drone strikes, kidnappings, torture, rendition, and even murdering their own citizens in drone strikes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. President Donald Trump both claimed that Qasem Soleimani was a terrorist, with Donald Trump writing on his Twitter that he was hated in the region. Not only is this statement by the U.S. completely baseless and false, it's extremely insulting, actually. You know, after they were martyred, millions of people came out to attend their funerals. Both General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi played an extremely important role in helping to crush Daesh in Syria and Iraq. So as a Syrian Christian myself, I'm personally grateful to them for this. They helped to liberate our lands from terrorism and saved countless lives from all backgrounds, including minorities and others that would have been killed at the hands of Daesh, terrorists that the United States and its allies helped to create in the first place. So this is why after Haj Qasim was martyred, we saw several processions and masses even being held in his honor, recognizing his work. Joining me from Tehran is Dr. Sam Torabi, Director of Risalat Strategic Studies Institute. Thanks for joining me, Sam. How are you?
My pleasure.
We saw a really touching interview recently from Haj Qasim's daughter, Zainab Soleimani, where she spoke of how her father, he wasn't just fighting for Iran, but, you know, for all people, for a greater good. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been the story of the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution for 40 years, you know. I mean, the movement that happened with, you know, the Iranian nation and Imam Khomeini as its leader, you know, more than 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, was a global movement. It was a movement about, you know, truth versus, you know, those forces in this world who want to oppress people. And the movement in Iran, the Islamic Revolution, the revolutionary movement in Iran, decided to not go that path. And of course, this is based on Islam, the real Islam, the Islam of the Prophet, peace be upon him, the Islam of the school of Ahlul Bayt, which neither, you know, accepts being oppressed nor accepts that one becomes an oppressor. So this is the school that Haj Qasim was living. He was an embodiment of it. He was a manifestation of it. And so when the Islamic Republic, when the state in Iran decided that they're going to, you know, make those strategic decisions that they did, which ended up that those forces then went into Syria, that was part of a larger thing. And the larger thing was what I was, you know, referring to right now, which is that it's not just about, you know, preventing Daesh from taking over Syria or any force that's going to cause havoc in the region, or, you know, some sort of a cynical power play between Iran and its enemies. It was a larger issue. It was, as we say in Farsi and Arabic, haq and batil. You know, that was what the war was about. Those who lived it, who saw it, I'm sure, you know, you can tell us more about this. That war in Syria really showed us the true faces of everybody. It was no longer about the labels, you know, Sunni Shia, Christian, Muslim, you know, leftist, rightist. You know, everybody had to choose the right, had to choose, you know, haq or batil. And it became very clear very soon who's on the side of haq and who's on the side of batil.
So with the one-year anniversary upon us, the United States is claiming that, you know, Iran is firing rockets at the Green Zone at the embassy in Baghdad and saying that they're ready to retaliate against Iran. You know, it seems as though they're preemptively blaming Iran for something that they're going to do.
Well, I mean, all of them, Trump, Biden, you know, Democrats, Republicans, they're delusional. They think that, you know, that the Iraqi people don't have their own will. They think that the Syrian people don't have their own will. They think that, you know, the Lebanese people don't have their own will. They see everything through the lens of Iran. You know, it's a mental problem. I don't know how we can solve it. You know, they can't accept the reality that Iraqis would actually not like to be occupied and would actually resist. They can't fathom that. It doesn't fit into their, I don't know what we can call it. You know, the same goes for the Syrian people. The fact that, you know, the Syrian people would resist and not want, you know, crazy, fanatic, Takfiri, Wahhabi, allow them to take over the country and they would actually rise up and they would defend their own country, you know, with all the problems that might have existed in the system of governance that existed prior to the Civil War. Nobody denies that. Nobody says that it was heaven. Nobody says that there weren't issues. But the issue is, you know, what's haq and what's batil? Obviously, you know, people are not going to sit there and just watch their country be ruined. Same goes for the Lebanese people and their resistance to the Zionist occupation of their lands and the continued threat that they face from the Zionists. So these are the problems that we have with the West, with the British, with the French, and now with the Americans as the inheritors of the imperial powers, as the inheritor of the British Empire, and also to a certain extent the French, for those countries that were under French influence. So they just can't, you know, believe that people would have their own agency and decide that they don't want to be occupied and that they might want to resist occupation. And let's not forget, you know, we talk about the American embassy, but it's actually, you know, it's the size of the Vatican. I mean, it's a huge, you know, it's basically the Americans are occupying a major part of Baghdad, which is the capital of a sovereign state. And in many ways, they want to effectively turn it into American soil, which is technically what happens when you have an embassy. It's technically the soil of the country in terms of the laws or in terms of the ability of the country in which that embassy is located to enter into that area. So, you know, it's not a building. It's not a bunch of towers or a bunch of buildings or whatever. It's an entire section of Baghdad, which, you know, is being ripped away from Iraqi sovereignty. And so this is a problem. This is not something that can last in the long run. This is something that, you know, imperial powers do. This is what countries do that want to come and stay for, you know, centuries, which, you know, is again another delusion among the Americans.
Right. So, I mean, America thinks that, oh, Iran fired a few rockets in response and that's it. But they don't even really have someone of the same value or caliber as Haj Qasem on their side.
Well, what we have with Qasem, what we had with Abu Mahdi, these were exceptional human beings. These were people who worked on themselves. These were people who struggled and who reached a high level of consciousness, who reached a high level of purity in their personal behavior and in their lives. You know, let's not even go there with some of the things that we see. Many cases where, and this is all out in the open, where there is reports of massive corruption, personal and structural, within U.S. military. We have scandals erupting around the world where they are being bribed with, you know, things that I can't even mention on TV right now. And so, you know, these are like admirals and captains and generals and colonels. And these are supposed to be the so-called, you know, whatever army of the United States, the military forces of the United States. These are supposed to be the leaders of, so, you know, whatever mythology they want to create from it. And, you know, for us, we have to even not even put these two on a level where we can compare them. I'm talking about Haj Qasem, I'm talking about and of course, you know, the thousands of others who, like them, of their generation, after them. You know, when you enter into that, world, it's a world where you have to really purify yourself. It's not something that is going to just go away. It's not something that is going to go away with sanctions. I mean, you know, just think about any other country or society in history having to endure these sanctions would have collapsed, you know, and yet we didn't, and we haven't, and thriving. Yes. Most Iranians don't have to worry about the basic necessities of life. Not only that, but we also have been able to really advance on in ways that, you know, we were told the only way you can do that is if you connect yourself to some great power and become their obedient servant, and, you know, they will give you the technology.
Sam, thanks so much for your time and your valuable insight. Really appreciate having you on. Thank you so much. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So after Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi were martyred, how do you see the future of the Axis of Resistance?
Well, you know, this is another thing that's a Western problem, which is that their system of commanding and their system of leading is you have some heroic figure, you know, leading a bunch of sheep. And so if you get rid of that heroic leader, the sheep don't know what to do. But that's not the way it works here. The way it works
right.
is the whole movement that Imam Khomeini led is you have human beings being developed. So it's not that Haj Qasim was this person who is irreplaceable. Yes, he is irreplaceable to a certain extent in terms of a historic figure. But, you know, it's not like when with him leaving or with Abu Mahdi not being here that things are going to change in any way, shape, or form. We have a system that's trying to actually develop human beings who are multifaceted, who not only look at things in terms of career and in terms of advancing their own personal ambitions, but in terms of building themselves and purifying themselves and self-edification. And so this is the kind of people that we have, you know, conducting the affairs, especially those who are involved in the military, whether it's the guards or whether it's the army or whether it's Basij or any other branch that's working. So it's not going to make any difference because the strategic goal of the Islamic Republic is to expel the Americans from West Asia. It's the stated goal as stated by the Supreme National Security Council, as stated by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. This is the goal. And it doesn't matter if it's Haj Qasim who is commanding certain forces or whether it's others who are commanding it. Or it doesn't matter even if it's Ayatollah Khamenei who is the leader or not. These things are not going to change with the coming and going of people. As you may have seen in the way that these Americans talk, they always talk about, well, when Ayatollah Khamenei is gone, we will do this, we will do that. Well, you know, this is exactly the same thing they said when Imam Khomeini was alive. They said, well, when Imam Khomeini goes, we'll do this, we'll do that. So it's this false projection of their own way of doing things, which is you have some heroic figure leading a bunch of people who have no, you know, ability to think for themselves. This is not the way it works here. And so with him or without him, the path continues. The strategic goal, as I mentioned, is the expulsion of America from West Asia. It's going to happen. And of course, in terms of Israel, it's the establishment of a Palestinian state, of a Palestinian republic, where Christians, Muslims, Jews live as equal citizens of that Palestinian state. It's not about throwing the Jews into the sea, which is the propaganda that the Zionists always, you know, use when we talk about ending Israel. Ending Israel is not about killing Jews. It's not about getting rid of Jews. It's about ending a Zionist apartheid state. Exactly the way you had a apartheid state ending in South Africa, and it's evolving into a different thing. And so these goals are clear. We are not worried about, you know, losing the support of this president or that president. And so, you know, basing whatever we do on whoever is going to call us from some second-tier official from the U.S., you know, ordering us what to do or what not to do. You know, accept Israel and we'll give you, you know, this much money or whatever it was even during the time of the Shah, this was the case. It's not about, you know, being closed off to the world. It's about, you know, it's the system that we have in this region. The British called it and still call it Arab facade, which is the strategic, economic, and the security matters are determined by the West, and the leadership is Arab facade. This is in their own documents, and so these are the things that we're dealing with. Countries like Iran, countries like Syria, don't fit into that scheme of domination, and so that's why they're threatened, and in the case of Syria, you know, pulled into this tragic war that went on for so many years.
The killing of General Soleimani marked one of the biggest escalations between the United States and Iran in recent history, which is actually saying something given how many provocations the U.S. has committed vis-a-vis Iran just in the last 2 years alone. Many speculated that his slaying would ignite an all-out conflict. But one can argue that given the magnitude of this transgression, that Iran has actually shown unbelievable restraint, Just ask yourself for 1 second, if Iran had assassinated an American general, wouldn't America have declared war in response? Once again, we see this imperialist double standard where it's okay for the U.S. to violate international laws and commit terrorism while pointing the finger at others. Iran has maintained that its real response in order to properly avenge General Soleimani has not come yet, and that they are saving this for a later date. Now, 2 days after the assassination, back in January, the Iraqi parliament unanimously passed a bill demanding the expulsion of all American troops from their soil. After all, this was not just an act of aggression towards Iran, but also a violation of Iraq's sovereignty as it took place on their soil. The United States has been illegally occupying Iraq ever since its invasion in 2003 over weapons of mass destruction that were never found. And of course, the U.S. ignored this new measure by Iraqi lawmakers and has still not left Iraq. A few days later after the assassination, Iran fired a barrage of rockets at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq, which belongs to the illegal U.S. occupation forces. No one was killed in this attack, but the U.S. hilariously claimed that 110 of its personnel had received, quote, traumatic brain injuries from this attack. Again, one cannot really consider this a true response to the assassination of General Soleimani, as the U.S. military does not even have anyone who is really comparable or of the same value to Haj Qasem, no less a bunch of regular service members, as they call them. Nonetheless, in another significant move, Iran said it would no longer abide by the limitations of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or Iran Nuclear Deal, as it's also called. Iran said it would continue to cooperate with international monitors, but would abandon the constraints on the number of centrifuges it's allowed to have. This marked the fifth step in Iran reducing its commitment to the deal, after Trump unilaterally pulled out of it in May 2018, and then also slapped Iran with crippling sanctions, and also proceeded to order this assassination, which is frankly tantamount to a declaration of war. In the days following the killing, the U.S. Congress introduced the Iran War Powers Resolution in order to try and limit Trump's ability to use military force against Iran. It passed both the Democrat-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, only to be vetoed by Trump himself. In order to justify this act of terrorism, the Trump regime pointed not only to the U.S. Constitution, but also to the 2002 authorization of use of military force against Iraq. These arguments are farcical either way. Just because the U.S. Congress votes to attack another country, that doesn't mean that it is okay or legally acceptable. Even if both houses of Congress wanted to limit Trump's powers in this regard, it's still not up to the United States to unilaterally decide that it can attack other nations. U.S. law does not supersede the U.N. Charter nor international conventions. This is absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's actually very typical of American exceptionalism. Agnes Callamard, who's the U.N. Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, condemned the assassination of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi. She said the attack was an unlawful killing and concluded that the United States had violated the United Nations Charter. Speaking about a memo that the Trump regime gave to the U.S. Congress, she said information that Trump administration officials provided was remarkably vague and inconsequential as far as a possible imminent threat is concerned. Even at the most basic level, the U.S. did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary.
The targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, concluding that his was a violation of the UN Charter governing the use of force and an arbitrary killing. On January 3rd, 2020, the world moved into a very different space. On that day, the United States used unarmed drones to target and kill Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, as well as a number of his companions, including largely Iraqi representatives. That is a significant and troubling new development. It is the first known incident in which a state invokes self-defense as justification for an attack against a government official outside a declared armed conflict.
Recently, in the lead-up to the anniversary of the assassination, Washington has said it is moving personnel out of positions inside Iraq for fear of, quote, retaliation from Iran. The head of U.S. Central Command, Kenneth McKenzie, said the U.S. is prepared to react if Iran tries to avenge Soleimani's death. Once again, This is a hypocritical, ridiculous point, because the United States committed the original act of aggression, but it pretends that it is somehow the victim. Donald Trump also claimed on his Twitter that Iranian-made rockets had been fired at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, which shows that the U.S. is acting nervously and preemptively trying to blame any aggression that it might take on made-up stories. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, his rebuttal included a stark reminder of how the United States lied about the Iraq war, starting wars based on fabrications and doesn't really care about its own citizens. And indeed, if the United States claims to be a nation that promotes democracy and peaceful international relations, it cannot violate the UN Charter and violate international treaties and carry out extrajudicial assassinations. The slaying of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes was not just an act of terrorism. It's a stark reminder of American arrogance and hypocrisy, the real outcome of which we've yet to see. The United States can make up as many false intelligence reports as it likes and lie to its own citizens and the world, but General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi challenged U.S. hegemony, and that is ultimately the real reason that they were martyred. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The discovery of a new species of aloe, African leaf-nosed bats and chameleons that appear similar to the human eye but are in fact many and separate have thrilled and worried conservationists. Scientists say our planet might be more biologically diverse than previously thought, and estimates for the total number of species could be far higher than the current best guess of 8.7 million. But cryptic discoveries often mean that species once considered common and widespread are actually several, some of which may be endangered and required immediate protection. The Jonas mouse lemur was only unveiled to the world this summer, but is already on the verge of extinction. The newly described Popa langur in Myanmar, previously confused with another species, numbers around 200 and is likely to be classified as critically endangered, threatened by habitat loss and deforestation. The discovery of these cryptic species has been driven in part by the rise of DNA barcoding, a technique that can identify and differentiate between animal and plant species using their genetic divergence. African elephants, Indian vine snakes, and South American neotropical birds are among the growing number of unmaskings. Thousands more are expected in the coming years from living creatures and museum samples. We've prepared for you an article written by Patrick Greenfield under the heading "Discovery of Cryptic Species Shows Earth is More Biologically Diverse." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Patrick Greenfield's article. A growing number of cryptic species hiding in plain sight have been unmasked in the past year, driven in part by the rise of DNA barcoding, technique that can identify and differentiate between animal and plant species using their genetic divergence. The discovery of new species of aloe, African leaf-nosed bats and chameleons that appear similar to the human eye but are in fact many and separate have thrilled and worried conservationists. Scientists say our planet might be more biologically diverse than previously thought, and estimates for the total number of species could be far higher than the current best guess of 8.7 million. But cryptic discoveries often mean that species once considered common and widespread are actually several, some of which may be endangered and require immediate protection. The Jonas mouse lemur was only unveiled to the world this summer, but is already on the verge of extinction. The newly described Papa langur in Myanmar, previously confused with another species, numbers around 200, and is likely to be classified as critically endangered, threatened by habitat loss and deforestation. The discovery of these cryptic species has been driven in part by the rise of DNA barcoding, a technique that can identify and differentiate between animal and plant species using their genetic divergence. African elephants, Indian vine snakes, and South American neotropical birds are among the growing number of unmaskings. Thousands more are expected in the coming years from living creatures and museum samples. Brian Brown, entomology curator at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum, who is using the technique for research on flies, says, DNA barcoding is a tool that allows us to detect differences among species at a finer scale than before. Like a microscope allows us to see fine details of surface structure that are invisible to the naked eye. He added, it gives us a way to delimit some of the previously suspected but unexplored diversity within what we call species. It is showing that the world is even more wonderfully biodiverse than we suspected. The first cryptic species discoveries made using DNA barcoding were in Guanacaste Conservation Area, or ACG, in northwestern Costa Rica, now the most DNA barcoded place on Earth. In a paper titled 10 Species in One, Canadian professor Paul Herbert, known as the father of DNA barcoding, revealed the true identities of the two-barred flasher butterfly in 2004, along with the University of Pennsylvania professors Danielle Janssen and Winnie Horwalks, who have dedicated their lives to the Guanacaste Conservation Area. It was an insect that had bothered Janssen for decades. Taxonomic consensus told the 81-year-old evolutionary ecologist that the caterpillar samples he collected in the Guanacaste Conservation Area were those of a common, unremarkable tropical butterfly found from Texas to northern Argentina, but he did not believe it. Janssen had always been puzzled by the diversity of the two-barred flasher caterpillars, Astraptis fulgurator, and the variety of plants on which they feasted. So when in 2004 he had the opportunity to test a controversial new technique called DNA barcoding, put forward by Herbert, then primarily known for his expertise on water fleas, he knew which insect samples he would send. The results were thrilling. In his study area alone, the barcoding analysis indicated the two-barred flasher butterfly was in fact at least 10 genetically distinct species. The revelation of the butterfly as a cryptic species could mean across the rest of Latin America there are thousands of unidentified insect species waiting to be described, along with many that have never been collected and examined. The findings were highly controversial and provoked a backlash from taxonomists and biologists who questioned whether genetic information should be included in identifying a species. Others did not agree that a binary genetic threshold should be imposed on the continual process of evolution. For centuries, humanity's understanding of life on Earth was based on the physical form. According to the modern taxonomic system first developed by Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus, every organism in the library of life fits within a hierarchy of classifications based on appearance. Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus immodestly told people, "God created, Linnaeus organized." Today, the technique is commonly used alongside traditional Linnaean-based methods, quickly separating samples before further genetic and morphological analysis. Among the skeptics nearly 20 years ago was Brown, who is now responsible for a large unmasking. Species once lumped together as Megacelia sulphurizona, a type of humpback fly, also collected into the ACG. According to his unpublished research with co-authors, DNA barcoding analysis of samples across Latin America revealed 16 separate species. Another convert, Michael Sharkey, an entomologist and emeritus professor at the University of Kentucky, DNA barcoded the insects he had classified for his PhD, only to realize that most of the species concepts he had proposed after 3 years of hard work were incorrect. He wrote of the experience, "It would have been much better if I had never published. I'm happy to have had the experience, though. It has taught me that despite best efforts, morphological evidence is not sufficient. DNA barcodes will have their drawbacks as well, but they're a vast improvement." Brown said that if, as he suspects, some species are much rarer than previously thought, that only makes conservation efforts more urgent. Brown added, "I look at my flies and there are maybe 100,000, maybe a million, undescribed species of them in the world. We don't really know. But if we don't use methods that take into account genetic divergence, we're never going to get close to the truth."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Allah the Exalted has reiterated throughout the Quran that people should not forget what has happened to previous ummas. They were covered with humiliation and misery. They drew on themselves the wrath of Allah. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 61. This is just one of the ayahs in this regard, but there are many others where Moses said to Bani Israel, "O my people, did not your Lord make a beautiful promise to you? Did then the promise seem to you long in coming?" The Holy Quran, chapter 20, verse 86. "Until some time ago, you were under the pressure of the Pharaoh. Did the incident occur a long time ago that you have forgotten it? You say, 'O Moses, fashion for us a god like the gods they have.'" The Holy Quran, chapter 7, verse 138. These are lessons. These are points that I have always repeated. Today, pious, committed, and enthusiastic youth are better than compared to the beginning of the revolution in terms of quantity and quality. This is the case today. We are not dissatisfied, but you should take care to tread the right path. There's a great lesson presented to us by the Quran, the Holy Prophet, and God. Allah suffices for anyone who trusts Him. The Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 49. We should not forget this lesson, and we should always keep it in mind.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Now I wish to raise 2-3 points about our dear martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani. One point is about his character. Well, these days, many things have been said about that great personality, that good, dear, courageous, and fortunate comrade of ours who went to heaven. And what they said about him and his personality traits are correct. But I too wish to raise certain points which I think are important. Shahid Soleimani was both brave and insightful. His actions were not merely marked by courage. Some people have courage, but they do not have the necessary wisdom and acumen to utilize their courage. And some people enjoy wisdom, but they do not take action. They do not have the guts to take action. Our dear martyr both had the necessary guts and the necessary acumen.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. If you remember, we said that according to a religious tradition, the students who study in seminaries receive tuition from the sources of emulation in order not to face financial problems. This tuition is paid on the basis of the level of education. This tuition is maintained by the money gathered from almsgiving, mainly in the form of khums and zakat and endowments. Thus, the government has no role in this. That's why the Shia clerical structure has been independent of the ruling system throughout history. Since the early years of the advent of Islam, righteous and pious people have endowed large swathes of properties, including real estates, gardens, farms, factories, shops, etc., to the seminaries so that they could use them for administration of those religious centers. These monies are spent for education, teaching, research, propagation, management, and relevant jobs. Of course, the money paid to the students is not sufficient for an ordinary livelihood. Therefore, the seminary students have to lead a very simple life and forget about many daily requirements, let alone luxurious life. Payment of tuition to the seminary students is based on Ayah 41 of Surah Anfal of the Noble Quran, part of which reads, "And know that whatever you gain, one-fifth of it is for God and for the messenger and for the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the wayfarer." Dear listeners, stay tuned for more on this issue, please. Imam Khomeini would observe justice in the payment of tuition to the students of seminary. He would never consider nationality as a criterion for this purpose. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Sajjadi Isfahani says, "Before Imam Khomeini's coming to Najaf, there were some discriminations at seminaries, but the Imam eliminated these discriminations among Arab and non-Arab students. He used to say, if tuition has to be paid, it should be paid according to the level of the qualified students, no matter if they are Arab, Afghan, Indian, Pakistani, or Iranian." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would observe justice even in his behavior towards different students. It was customary in Najaf that the great ulema, after arriving in the city, would go to visit only the sources of emulation. But Imam Khomeini paid a visit to ordinary students of lower levels too. They would go to each and every madrasa in Najaf to thank the students who had accorded him welcome. Imam Khomeini was very careful not to harm the self-esteem of the students while paying them tuition. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Mohammadi Gilani said in this regard, "Imam Khomeini would try to distribute the tuition among the students in a way not to make them lose their self-esteem and be humble for money." Late Ayatollah Sadiq Khalkhali said, "The Imam would respect students and ulema very much and believe that the clergymen should be sacred." Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to behave very respectfully and nobly with those students who would not ask for their basic needs out of self-esteem and dignity. That's why he would always inquire from his near ones about the tuition of such students. Hujjatul Islam Ismail Ferozipur says in this regard, "In Najaf, Imam Khomeini had said, if any student or anyone among your neighbors is in need and poor, while two people whom I know testify this to me, I will help them." Several times, we would go to the Imam and tell him that someone needs a fan or a carpet, and the Imam would help them. Imam Khomeini always tried to identify poor and needy students to help them. Hujjatul Islam Forghani recounts an interesting memory. In Najaf, before starting the class, Imam Khomeini would look at the shoes. One day, he noticed a pair of shoes that were shabby and unusable. He was upset and told one of the authorities after the class, "Tomorrow you have to go and find the owner of these shoes. Then find his house and tell me." That man said that the day after, he did as the Imam had asked him. The Imam gave him a full set of clothes and shoes. Hujjatul Islam Amiri also says, sometimes Imam Khomeini would leave for the holy shrine or something else. Then he would come back and order some of his near ones to buy clothes for a poor student that he had seen outdoors. He continues, one day someone came to the Imam and showed his cloak, saying, "My cloak is torn." The Imam showed his cloak to him and said, "Look, my cloak is torn too." He would answer some people like this to prevent their misuse. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was very careful about infiltration of security forces of the Iraqi Baathist regime in his classes under the guise of students. He would order their names to be omitted from the list of the students in order not to pay them tuition. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Jafar Karimi says in this regard, Imam Khomeini once said, "The Baathist government intends to close the Najaf seminary, and I am religiously obliged not to let this happen. One of the ways to do this is to address the efforts of the students and to increase their tuition. But since the tuition that I want to pay belongs to the Imam of the age, it should be accounted for and paid to those who are qualified to study at the seminary and are capable of reaching high scientific degrees. I have heard that the names of indecent persons are enrolled in the list of tuition, and they receive tuition from me. They should be omitted, and persons should be reviewed." We have started this and saw that he was right. Unfortunately, we came across the names of persons who wore the clothes of seminaries but were affiliated to the Baathist security of Iraq. They were moles of the Baathist party, so their names were omitted. Imam Khomeini was very careful on the payment of tuition to the students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Fazil Lakhrani said, although Imam Khomeini was able to build scores of madrasas and even hospitals, he didn't build any of them. He didn't build even a library, because he believed that the money should be used to provide relative welfare for students. This was his habit for encouraging students to study and research.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies: the Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans.
As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believed that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasim